So for those of you who was here last year, year before? Okay, so Michael, because he continually does such a good job, we make him continue to do it. So he's threatened us that he won't do such a good job, just to kind of stop. But I think he's incapable of not doing an excellent job. So without further ado, Michael Stewart.
Very funny. Well, you know, when you have 3 days of full conferencing, outstanding science, and just incredibly rich perspectives, you really have to ask yourself, you know, how do you sum that all up? And if anybody has any answer to that question, I invite your suggestions right now. But I'm going to do my able best to do that as someone who has attended these meetings for 10 of the last 11 years and who has been a strong supporter and fan of this work, and knowing how important it is to making a contribution to advancing HIV and prevention. HIV treatment and prevention. So highlights from Adherence 2016. I have no conflicts to report. And I'll start just by noting the evolution of this meeting over the course of time. It began with a strong focus on ART adherence, and then it did evolve, as Michael Mogavero and Reveille have noted, to incorporate greater focus on HIV care engagement and retention, and then more recently, biomedical prevention, PrEP and TASP. And I think it's also very important to note this year how there's such a strong and increasing focus at this meeting around other cross-cutting issues, things like stigma, dignity, and rights. And really, in many ways, you can kind of think of these as four posts of a table helping to support our efforts in HIV treatment and prevention. And the table is going to be that much less strong for missing one of these important four posts. So it's really nice to see these as four corners of this important meeting. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what I heard at this meeting and what I think that we heard. One of those messages is that we are making progress, but significant gaps and disparities remain that we need to keep on working on. We've gotten a variety of good news at this meeting, and some of that relates to antiretroviral treatment. In the top three plenary today, we heard about how we've had improved viral suppression in young adults here in the U.S., and we're also seeing improvements in ART coverage, and over time there's improved ART persistence. People are staying longer on their regimens as time goes by. And some of this is due to probably the regimens themselves, which have improved and become more tolerable. And some of it's also probably due to our advancing efforts to improve support for adherence. We also heard just now from Julio Montaner about the progress that the world is making towards the 90-90-90 goals, with a particular example of what's happened in British Columbia, but not just in British Columbia, also in Botswana. And as Ambassador Birx told us the other day, even in a number of PEPFAR countries, such as Rwanda, where we're getting closer and closer, or even exceeding some of these 90-90-90 goals, that's just terrific progress. At the same time, while we have those excellent headlines, we have to look underneath them and recognize that disparities do remain. And here in the U.S., if you do look beyond the improvements that we're seeing in viral suppression among young people, we still see that there are age disparities as they relate to viral suppression. And in general, people, youth and young adults, are having a harder time staying on ART and remaining virally suppressed. We also have evidence of racial disparities. In a poster presented here based on data from Virginia, there was a more than twofold likelihood of loss of viral suppression among HIV patients who are African American compared to patients who are white among individuals engaging in care in that state. And also very troubling, but today, Adia Rana presented from this stage, indicating that we see extremely low retention and also high mortality among U.S. mothers over the long term. You know, it's one of the signal public health achievements that we've virtually eliminated mother-to-child transmission in the United States. But what is you know, disconcerting in parallel is how poor those women who go on over time after they've had that child, how poor their outcomes are. And so we need to do something not just for PMTCT, but also to make sure that those women are well supported going forward. There's also good news in terms of prep. At this conference, we've heard about how, especially among USMSM, we see increased prep awareness, interest, and uptake among this population. Attitudes are improving, and there's dramatic and expanding efforts to speed access to and delivery of PrEP to populations that could benefit from it. Just the plenary from Ken Mayer the other day was another outstanding example of the many possible ways that we might advance that work. There are places that we may be lagging on PrEP, and indeed we do have some evidence that there are some racial and ethnic disparities in uptake among MSM. The coalition that's working in San Francisco has identified transgender individuals as a priority population whose needs are not yet being met. Ken Mayer in his plenary reminded us that there's still some disparities in terms of urban and rural or widespread access to PrEP worldwide. Cisgender women, we were just noting their needs. Oni Blackstock had presented on a program in the Bronx. And what it seems is that there are women who are accessing PrEP, which is excellent, but it may be that the ones that are most at risk are not, in fact, getting access to PrEP. And so we still have some more work to do to make sure that it gets into the hands of those who could best benefit from it. And I love this quote from one of Oni's partners, that PrEP may not be for every woman, but it's an option for all women. So another thing we heard at this conference was the importance of setting goals, of staying focused, and working together. And we've seen this at several levels, and the first is the global. Ambassador Birx powerfully told us about the efforts underway in PEPFAR to further strengthen the impact of treatment and prevention in PEPFAR countries through a greater effort to deliver targeted approaches, delivering the right things in the right places right now. You're making the best possible use of the funding that's available to us to address HIV and turn the tide of the epidemic worldwide. At the national level, Amy Lansky told us about the United States National HIV/AIDS Strategy and the many goals and foci that it has for the next several years in terms of advancing treatment and prevention here in the US. And critical areas that it will seek to focus on, which include expanding access to PrEP, widespread HIV testing, and further support for people with HIV. All in the name of achieving universal viral suppression. Beyond the global or the national level, Ruben Granich told us about the effort that IOPAC is leading to create fast-track cities and to expedite progress in terms of HIV prevention goals and treatment access worldwide, in particular localities that are agreeing to meet these targets of 90-90-90 in addition to zero stigma and discrimination. And the number of fast-track cities is growing by the day, and it's just great to see that effort underway. Beyond the global, the national, and the city, there's also the community. And the community-based organizations and non-governmental organizations play a critical role, again, as noted by Ambassador Birx in her plenary the other day, as well as Amy Lansky, who pointed out that the National HIV/AIDS Strategy is not a federal plan, it's a national plan. And as a national plan, it has a critical role for community partners to advance the many goals that are inside of that work. And I think one of the things that was very interesting to hear at this meeting was the number of multi-sectoral coalitions that are coming forward now to try to advance HIV prevention. I'm only including two here, there was many more, but that includes the Getting to Zero Coalition in San Francisco, which is a collection of a variety of the public health agencies as well as community-based organizations and medical providers. And then even, as Ken Mayer noted in his talk, emergent efforts, such as one that's underway in St. Louis to join together groups to help advance PrEP delivery in that location. So it's great to see those coalitions underway. How will we further our work? Well, data is going to guide the way and improve our efforts, and we heard that theme very strongly at this meeting. Bruce Agins on May 9th delivered his plenary talking about how we can harness data to guide local, state, and national HIV initiatives. And of course, prominent inside of that are these data to care efforts, which are using surveillance data to try to find individuals who are out of care and then return them to care. But Bruce spoke powerfully about the ability to do quality improvement efforts. and to establish things like care continuum dashboards, or to use electronic medical records to provide provider alerts in ways that can help to improve the kind of care that we deliver and reduce gaps in the care continuum. And we've seen examples of that, such as the National HIV/AIDS Strategy Indicators, which are looking at a whole set of metrics to evaluate how the U.S. is doing. And then at the state level, New York State has its End the Epidemic Dashboard, which is also monitoring progress in that location. Bruce spoke about quality improvement initiatives where one can take a data-driven approach to trying to improve, identify barriers, address those that are most prominent, and then improve outcomes and monitor their impact. That may be done at the facility level, at a regional or even a national level. We also had Michael Horberg speak about these kinds of big data approaches, and he pointed out that they are very complex to affect, especially when you're dealing with data care systems that are, or data systems that are in care contexts. But for their complexity, they also have incredible value in terms of understanding where we stand and where we need to go as far as improving our work. One way that we can increase the impact of these data-driven approaches was noted by Bruce, and again, that's by working collaboratively. And through the NY Links program, they are improving the quality and impact of data-driven approaches in that state by creating partnerships between public health, clinic, and community-based organizations. So that they can actually use these dashboards to, for example, find individuals who are out of care and work together with community collaborators to bring them back into care. And I love this quote from his talk, "When spiderwebs unite, we can tie up a lion." And it just speaks to the power of our efforts to work together and to work collaboratively. One last thing about the data-driven approaches, and you know, we've seen some excellent examples of how one can do geographic targeting. One could also do this in the clinic context or many other levels, but this example comes from the IOPAC Fast Track Initiative, where in their website and app, which are under development, they're able to map HIV infections and resources and help people to access care, as well as for us to chart our progress in terms of addressing the epidemic. And we also had individuals here from AIDSView, which is an organization that's establishing these kinds of maps here in the U.S. So I want to turn now to highlight some work at this conference in particular areas that the conference is focused on. I'll start with PrEP, research on PrEP use and delivery. One of the most interesting aspects to come out of the meeting was how we're seeing more research indicating that PrEP is being used in a manner that corresponds to this idea of seasons of risk, that PrEP is not for a lifetime, but instead that PrEP is for individuals when they're experiencing contexts of risks or particular risk behaviors. And so through Jessica Haberer's abstract presented here from the main stage today on the top three plenary session, as well as an abstract from Thomas Whitfield in New York, and also Alex Gonzalez's breakfast session on PrEP. What we see in all of these is that there's this association between PrEP use and adherence in association with ongoing degree of risk. So for example, if individuals adopt a certain risk practice or preventive practices, or if they decide that they've had a decrease in risk, they might choose to discontinue PrEP. And that individuals who are currently using PrEP are more likely to adhere and to use it when they have concurrent risk behavior. So it's interesting to see this, and it shows how people are making decisions about their PrEP use in response to their immediate and personal situations. A number of abstracts here talking about PrEP services, almost all of which are pioneering because they're so new. There's a variety of different possibilities. We've heard about people integrating PrEP care into STI clinics, also integrating it into primary care. An excellent example coming out of Oakland in terms of how PrEP might be integrated into a HIV clinic setting in a way that's engaging for young people of color. Also some work out of New York on the value of PrEP specialists, having an individual who's actually holds the responsibility for helping people to access PrEP, get access to things like financial coverage, and to provide associated counseling. So having somebody who actually is on board in a clinic that can help out with those things. There's a variety of work here on monitoring PrEP adherence. I won't go into that in depth, but we see that there's a variety of methods that we might use going forward to help monitor PrEP adherence over time. And I think we're also hearing a lot of work around the various barriers to PrEP implementation, which are certainly multi-level. And prominently above them is the issue of insurance and access to healthcare, which we do have data, Suzanne Dobblecki-Lewis presenting how insurance issues are a challenge that can prevent people from, men from MSM and transgender individuals from continuing to use PrEP over time. We've seen some evidence of racial disparities on multiple levels that could potentially compromise PrEP use. And a very interesting abstract that was actually based on a vignette study but with medical students, but which suggests that heterosexism among medical providers might compromise the way that clinicians work with gay patients around their use of PrEP. And that's very troubling. It suggests that we need to do not just education around PrEP, but also cultural competence training in terms of how we work with these populations that are at risk. Gaps in the PrEP cascade, there's a kind of a complementary, you know, care continuum in the PrEP cascade, and there's a lot yet to be done to optimize the PrEP cascade and to make sure that the number of people who could benefit from it are accessing this preventive tool. And then I just want to acknowledge that this group has also helped to think a little bit bigger about prevention, you know, going beyond PrEP to look at the whole person and how people might engage in a variety of preventive services. We heard Jeremiah Johnson talk about the need to develop a prevention continuum that's a bit larger than what we might see just for PrEP alone, and how we need to develop comprehensive models of HIV prevention service delivery for individuals who are HIV negative and at risk. The sex-positive plenary panel encouraged us to move beyond a focus on disease towards holistic and sexual well-being. And I love Dazan's idea to develop a program around PrEP Flix and Chill, which might invite women to talk about, through movies and entertainment clips, you know, their interests in relationships and their social and sexual needs. And then lead into a conversation about how they might engage with prevention more generally. And then today we also heard from Catherine Hansens, who explains very importantly how HIV transmission criminalization is just not helpful, to say the least. It's both counterproductive and also wrong. So we have to think about that broader context. In terms of work on linkage, retention, and re-engagement, I think there was abundant work here indicating that a significant challenge for this area relates to depression and substance abuse, that these are real challenges to HIV care engagement and retention. We have yet to get a real good grip on how best to address that. I think there's a lot of work yet to be done. And it's interesting to see this work coming not just out of the United States, but also internationally in Russia and in Kenya. We saw work trying to identify a lot of times we're focused on re-engaging individuals who have left care to bring them back into care, but Brian Pence and Michael Mugavero and others are encouraging us to think proactively about this problem. Can we identify metrics to help identify people who might be at risk for falling out of care and then target them for support and intervention before they leave care? And it looks like missed visits are highly, you know, past behavior is highly predictive of future behavior, and that's certainly one of those indicators in terms of who might be lost over time. Data to care approaches, prominently featured here. A number of different abstracts talking about lessons learned and ways to make these data to care approaches more efficient, both here in the US and then also in Mexico. And an interesting abstract from Jason Craw and colleagues at the CDC indicating that there's certainly room for improvement in current care practice regarding retention support strategies. Only 1 in 5 providers work in facilities that provide 5 recommended retention services. Certain retention services are actually very common here in the US, things like reminding people of the importance of follow-up visits or giving it reminders for appointments. But other services, you know, such as systematic monitoring of retention or patient navigation, are actually employed much more infrequently. And so there's some work that could be done to strengthen those efforts more universally. And then Julia Dombrowski has introduced the idea that, you know, when we're dealing with the most difficult cases, it may be that we don't try to change people, but we really need to focus on changing our care. And so she provided the example of the Max Clinic in Seattle, which is trying to change the way that care is delivered in a manner that might help to engage those individuals who have not been helped by standard efforts to engage in care. And the Max Clinic has targeted these individuals who are, in general, they're out of care. Some of them have been returned to care through a data-to-care effort. But it provides walk-in care, close case coordination, a variety of things like snacks and meal vouchers, and even financial incentives. I guess it didn't quite come out here, but there's some financial incentives for people engaging in care at regular appointments and also for achieving viral suppression. And so far they're seeing that this model is very promising. And then other efforts to improve linkage and retention noted here. I won't go into them in depth. Trying to find individuals through respondent-driven sampling, facilitating linkage through point-of-care CD4, patient navigation models, and taking a multi-component approach. Not all of these approaches have been proven to be effective. We heard Carol Golan report Abstract 99 today, which tried mightily to connect individuals leaving jail to HIV services and care in an effort to promote viral suppression. And even what's notable about that is that it was a randomized controlled trial, and I think it's an excellent example of how we need to continue to do rigorous science in this area around linkage and retention. And if we, you know, don't see success, then we have to keep on, you know, moving forward and trying to advance, you know, what we can in this area. I'll switch then to ART adherence research, the full focus of this meeting for such a long time. And we might think about how we improve adherence on multiple levels. We can start with the regimens themselves. Ben Young, in his plenary, alluded to how long-acting regimens are currently in development. Very long-acting regimens, ones that are administered through injections on maybe a monthly or a bi-monthly or even twice a year basis, would certainly help to reduce the burden of adherence, the burden of daily adherence. But they also need to think a little bit about how they'll change our work in the sense that we might be moving more away from helping people engage with daily regimens, daily oral regimens. But on the longer term, when these regimens become available, we have to think about how we keep people engaged in care. You know, how are we doing in terms of keeping people engaged in care? You know, we could do a lot better. And so the idea that people will come back routinely for these injections is something that we're going to have to keep our eyes on and how we can still facilitate that. Beyond the regimens themselves, we can do individual approaches. And a really interesting piece from Laura Whiteley on a gaming approach for improved ART adherence in youth. They had a game that could be played on a handheld cell phone, an iPhone, and in their early pilot RCT, they found evidence for improved condom use as well as improved adherence as measured electronically among individuals who were using this game, which kind of engages people both on a gaming level, but also provides them some education about their health. And then very interestingly is connected to an electronic monitor, a Wise Pill monitor. And if you stay adherent over time electronically, you can level up in the game. And so there's some incentives for taking adherence, for being adherent in the real world that apply to your game. Individual counseling and group clinical visits, promoting adherence among people of color who are living with HIV, a randomized trial from Laura Bogart, and pilot work, again, coming from Oni Blackstock, on a group clinical visit model, both showing great promise. And then just a really interesting set of work coming out of Maria Guatz and colleagues around individuals who have chosen not to initiate ART and how we might work with them to on this issue. And the thing that's so interesting here is what they've found is that if they take an approach where they're very validating of people's choice to decide that they don't want to be on treatment, that ironically opens up a space where people think more critically about that decision. And so through motivational interviewing principles and support for this kind of autonomy and choice, they actually are finding a support among individuals to engage in a personal decision-making process that leads to ART initiation. And this is also an important aspect here, that this particular approach acknowledges racism and other historical challenges around medical care and incorporates culturally appropriate elements in terms of working with people. So very interesting work. You can't just work with individuals. There's a variety of structural constraints that come to play when it comes to ART adherence, employment, transportation, food insecurity, survival needs. Those were evident here again. And so we also have to think about how we incorporate these kinds of issues into our interventions. And so for that reason, it's really great to see a set of work here that addresses things like trauma-informed care, housing assistance, and food support, all in an effort to drive greater ART adherence and to improve viral suppression. And then going forward, I think one thing really important to note that we also heard on this stage is how critical it is to address stigma. And there was two pieces here, one from Jonathan Rendina, which found day-level associations between internalized stigma and ART adherence. On days when individuals living with HIV felt more stigma, they were less likely to take their medication. And then, also concerningly, in an abstract presented by Whitney Smith from UAB, HIV stigma in healthcare settings is predictive of viral suppression. So individuals who are going to healthcare clinics, and whether it's, it may not be from their providers, it might be from the staff, but if they're having experiences that lead to stigma or shame in healthcare settings, that is actually associated with a loss of viral suppression. And it also connects to the experience of depression in this study. And that's just very concerning. You know, that's something that we need to work on very carefully. Getting to zero stigma is going to require a lot of work and a lot of patience. We heard from Jason Sigurdsson today about plans to try to get to zero. And interestingly, we see another example of a data-driven approach here where the idea is to develop an HIV stigma index of people living with HIV stigma index, which has now been administered to many thousands of people around the world, and then to kind of map the distribution of stigma and discrimination so that we might target our public health efforts and any kind of educational or intervention campaigns to the areas that are most in need. So I just want to conclude then by noting another important theme of this meeting, and that is the power of the human element. And we heard this so amazingly from Robert Remyan in the delivery of the Ryder and Kaplan Memorial Lecture. Bob, reflecting on his lifetime of work, as well as his own life, reminded us of how the human element is absolutely critical in all of our efforts to advance HIV care and prevention. And that the many kinds of initiatives that we might undertake, even if they're taken at the large level of populations and data-driven approaches, you know, will never succeed if we don't consider the needs of the actual individuals who are so deeply affected by a whole host of personal and societal concerns. The really amazing to see the reunion of Dr. Ben Young with Jeremiah Johnson. Jeremiah spoke so powerfully of how he had been diagnosed with HIV and then found the incredible connection to Ben, who not just provided medical care to him, but really, again, attended to the human element by helping him understand what it means to live with HIV, and what the how to find support, you know, for going forward when you have a diagnosis. And so beyond the patient and provider relationships, I just also want to note the power of one, the power of one individual to make a difference. And it was on this stage that Bob Remyan so powerfully spoke about his own life as someone who's living with HIV. And I think of his example and the example of so many other people who are living with HIV and the kinds of leadership that they've contributed to advancing HIV care and prevention, access to life-saving drugs. And it's without that kind of advocacy and that kind of effort, we certainly would not be standing here today talking about where we need to go and standing on, you know, both successes and also, you know, challenges yet to be tackled. So I'm thankful for his example. I'm thankful for everyone's contributions. And I would only remind all of us that we each individually have the power to make change. And I really look forward to working with this conference and with each of you as we go forward to affect those kinds of goals. So I thank you very much.
Wow. Thank you. If you could write that up for us, that'd be great. Thank you so much for sticking with us. I know this was a really long and really intense conference, and on behalf of my co-chair, who had to leave already by now and sends his regrets, myself, and also on behalf of IPAC, we want to thank you for all of your contributions. We think this has been a great conference this year, and I would say a large part of that is really who's in the audience and what kinds of questions we get and what kind of conversations we have outside these doors. So again, thank you, and we hope to see you again next year. Thank you.